do very briefly is just talk a little bit about some of the most recent last 2 years sort of activities around questions about decolonising curriculum, decolonising universities, and sort of what's been happening particularly in England, if that's my focus. And then say a little bit, as I am a historian, about the some of the wider trends within student activism around these kinds of issues. And finish up with some of the criticisms around these campaigns, which I think tell us quite a lot about the sort of current standing of debates around post-colonial decolonizing within British popular discourses. So, I'm sure most people know quite a bit about what the campaigns around decolonizing the curriculum, the Roads Must Fall campaign, which began in the University of Cape Town in South Africa in 2015. But it did come out of some existing discussions and debates. And in this country, I think one of the first real discussions started around the 2011 NUS report called Race for Equality. So they did 2 years of research around race in universities in England, well, in the UK, and published in 2011. And they found that one in six students within UK higher education had experienced racism in their current institution. 34% of students felt that they were unable to bring their perspective as a black student to their lecture or to tutor meetings, and 42% believed that the curriculum didn't reflect issues of diversity, equality, and discrimination. So they published this report and then have been working quite substantially on those kinds of issues over the years since. And in 2015, the activity around these kinds of issues coalesced around the attainment gap. So they've been working quite substantially on the attainment gap. Hopefully people are aware of what I mean by that. The idea that black and minority ethnic students can come in with the same A-levels, but they're far less likely to leave with good degrees, T1 or first degrees. So there's something going on within higher education which disadvantages black and minority ethnic students. And the NUS passed a resolution at their 2015 conference clearly stating that the problem is not students themselves, but institutional racism. So they've been looking specifically at institutional racism, the ways in which power and hierarchies and the actual structures and institutions are creating, continuing this discrimination. So the Roads Must Fall campaign, as we happened, starts in South Africa. It comes to Oxford in November of 2015 when students issued a press release calling for the statue of Rhodes to be taken down at Oriel College, saying that the statue was a veneration not only of the crimes of the man himself, so it's not just about Rhodes, but also the racist imperial legacy on which Oxford University has thrived, as well as a metaphor for the racism BME individuals continue to experience at Oxford. So Rhodes as a symbol not just of the colonial past, but also for ongoing racism and discrimination and the money that Oxford has. So that was released in November, as I said, 2015. The following month, Oriel College did announce that they were going to remove the plaque commemorating Cecil Rhodes and consider dismantling the statue. They received such a hostile backlash from alumni and from tutors and dons at Oxford that they backpedaled. So just 6 weeks later, they said that they weren't going to do that after all, but that instead they would add an explanation of the historical context of Rhodes. And Oxford, of course, isn't the only place. This is springing up in 2015, 2016, all over the place. So it's SOAS. Students were calling to decolonize the university. And they focus particularly, so both on the curriculum and on the ways in which BME students and faculty and staff were being treated and discriminated against. But their arguments were more often about the curriculum. And about the ways in which they saw their curriculum, the structural assumption around the creation of a canon, and around the ways in which countries were depicted as backward or underdeveloped, and how that was structurally replicating colonial attitudes Sussex as well had a conference, I like the title of it, Decolonizing Education Towards Academic Freedom and Pluriversality. And after that, had an 11-point program from the Students' Union about the ways in which they were going to decolonize the curriculum. UCL, of course, and their program of Why Is My Curriculum White? Questioned the Eurocentric domination and lack of diversity in their curricula. And there were campaigns also at Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, and also here at Portsmouth. So the Students' Union here at Portsmouth had an NUS sort of race in your face campaign, including two events, one at which they spoke, so she might be able to tell us more about that. And really, so fundamentally, the issues about the calls to decolonize the curricula are far more broad than just about reading lists and those kinds of things, about the structural inequalities that take place. How am I doing for time?
5 minutes.
Okay, so I'm halfway. This is good. So then I'm going to move on and talk about how these movements aren't actually that new. So the NUS has positioned itself as an anti-colonial organization since the end of the Second World War, as much as they could. So from their 30s to 1968, the NUS was only allowed to discuss issues which affected students because they were students, Clause 3 of their constitution. So they had lots of policies against imperialism within education, and the ways in which they had passed resolutions at the conference in the 50s about the ways in which colonialism impacted on the education of non-white people in colonies and those kinds of things. So they took a very anti-colonial stand. In the late 60s, we see, of course, student activism, student protests around the world in the late 60s around a number of issues. In the UK, I think it's often, the UK is often overlooked within those discussions, and it's also overlooked largely what those issues were about in the UK. So in other places, they were about Vietnam, or in Germany, about the legacies of Nazism, etc. In the UK, really, the first bits of student activism were around apartheid, and particularly at the LSE, 1966. Those sit-ins and the demonstrations that really started at the LSE were about the appointing of Sir Walter Adams as the new director of the LSE, and he was coming from being principal of the College of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, and it was the issue for students at that time was about confirming or accepting apartheid as a legitimate system, and sort of the pollution of the LSE with this the appointment of this man. I think another legacy, and we can talk about that more in detail, but another legacy is the stuff that was happening at the Hornsey College of Art, Hornsey and Guildford. I'm not sure people know as much about that. So the Colleges of Art were occupied for a large section of the teaching year, 67-68, around issues of student having control over the curriculum. And it was really about students trying to take back the power of who had the right to write the curriculum and who had the right to decide what was an art curriculum. So there are certainly long-term trends there about power and hierarchy and breaking down those relationships. Of course, the NUS of the 70s and 80s had an anti-racist campaign the whole time. They were very active in anti-apartheid work, in divestment campaigns, getting their universities to not fund or invest in anything in South Africa while it was still an apartheid regime. From the mid-1980s, they were talking about access to higher education and further education for black and minority ethnic students. 1985, they found that a young black woman from a British city was 1,000 times less likely to gain a place at university than her white, male, non-urban colleagues. So they were doing that kind of research in the mid-80s already. So there are some long-term trends about student activism around race, immigration, post-colonial, decolonial activities. So just in the last kind of minute, these kind of debates, I think, fit very clearly in current discussions about the uses of history, the role of history, public history, what we teach as colonial history, and how that creates the world in which we live. And I just want to say the top five, I think, criticisms of the student campaigns, which I think tell us quite a lot about where debate sits. So first, the campaigns to decolonize the curriculum have been accused of being racist, because they assume that black and minority ethnic students aren't capable of reading Plato and Nietzsche or Kant or these kinds of things. That we need to change who's on the curriculum to make it accessible, which is actually a racist endeavor. Of course, I think it misses the point. It's not that students can't engage with it, but but challenging the idea that those are the best, the only people to read those kinds of things. Secondly, quite often is the criticism that this is just merely identity politics, that students just want to see reflected back themselves in the curriculum. I'm not entirely sure it's a bad thing to see yourself reflected back in the curriculum, fundamentally. But it again misses the point of the campaign. So it's not about seeing yourself reflected back, but about having a diversity of voices, and about the power and hierarchies of creating a canon that is of a particular type. And I think the representation issue, I think that shows us a bit about the wider stuff. So it's not just about reading lists having people, but why aren't there staff? Why aren't there professors who reflect back with students? Identities of any kind. Third, the argument about, well, this is adding in different kinds of histories distorts true history. I think historians all kind of shudder at that notion that there is a true history to be discovered, and that it is not all just interpretation. There are some facts, but the ways in which we construct the story are fundamentally crucial. Four, that it treats all, that it's relativist, that it treats all knowledge as equally good. Mm-hmm. This notion that actually Plato and Kant are actually just simply better than everyone else. So there's those kinds of arguments that actually, we can't widen things out to include more people because they're just not as good. And finally, the fifth one, which came up, which I think is quite interesting, is particularly in the session about beyond academia, is about the ways in which actually students are just pushing at an open door. That it's not students who are at the forefront of this, but actually their tutors are already there, already doing this stuff. And that there is some truth to that, I think. I think many academic staff are working to rethink curricula, rethink methods of teaching. But it's an odd one, because we teach our students to be critical, but we don't want them to be critical of us. Sets up something quite problematic. So we could talk about the ways in which it's actually students leading that, or is it an academic push that's happening? Anyway, I'm going to leave it there, and hopefully there are lots of things for discussion in that.
Thank you very much, Jodie. I'm sure something that we will come back to in the questions is how you actually argue with someone who's deliberately distorting your argument, which is a common issue, a common thing perhaps across today, and a big thing in the world in general. Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on to our next paper, which is E.K. Lutton, who is working at the University of Westminster now, so Westminster, second week is contingent. Continuing here after talking about that. And Ite's PhD was on Revisiting Silence, Memory of Colonialism in the UK and France from 1960 to present.
Thank you. A bit of an imposter here because everyone just had all of these very good general remarks to be made, and I thought that I was a bit, I didn't really know what to say, so I decided to tell a story, kind of a story of a certain organisation in France that, in a way, I hoped would show some of the specific contexts in France, talking about, first of all, about
colonialism, the memory of colonialism, and also how this involves many actors. And we're talking about a context in which memory has become a very kind of big political issue, such a big political issue that in 2016 the Senate even debated a bill to instaurer un jour de mémoire pour perpétuer notre histoire, sensibiliser les jeunes au sacrifice de leurs anciens et aux valeurs républicaines de la nation française, not saying what these things are actually supposed to be. So basically just a law for memory. And that came from a very specific context, and a specific context in which for about 15 years there has become a politics of memory, activism of memory, has become a thing in France. And it has become a thing through many different kinds of activism, and most notably different aspects of colonial history. So I'm not going to go into all of these things, but they're usually about different actors and different people who get into different, you can say, debates, you can say, conflicts in the public sphere. And the one thing I'm going to talk about today is an organisation that is called the Comité National pour la Mémoire et l'Histoire de l'Esclavage. So this is about how to commemorate slavery or colonial slavery. And so the committee's first avatar, so the Comité pour la Mémoire de l'Esclavage, was created by the Chirac government in 2004, and it mostly phases the state's involvement in commemoration of slavery. And this was done following the 2001 Taubira law that had defined slavery as a crime against humanity. So this politicization of the memory of slavery on a national level was the result of cooperation between Caribbean activists and politicians in France, without any real prominent presence of historians, of professional historians. I mean, this was about to change, though. So this kind of process of Antillean mobilisation of memory started around 1998. So what could be considered the opening shot was a protest against the government's plans to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the abolition of slavery and focus on the triumph of the values of the Republic while ignoring French responsibility for the enslavement of Africans. So the protest was the work of the association created by a couple of activists named Serge and Vivian Romana. There were two former Guadeloupean independentists who had turned their energy towards problems facing Caribbean communities in the metropole. So through Vivian Romana's work on trauma and its generational transmission, they'd begun focusing on the role of slavery as the kind of initial bond between the Republic and its Caribbean citizens. So accordingly, in their kind of idea of how to start working on this subject, is that the only way to establish a full citoyenneté of French Antillians would be through a recognition of this bond. So on the 23rd of May 1998, in Marche Silencieuse, which was led by the Romana's success uniting Caribbean associations in France, protested the government's plan and actually became a symbol for Antillean mobilisation in the metropole. Now, as a reaction to these protests, Antillean MPs began pushing for some kind of a legal basis for a commemoration of slavery and the recognition of the transatlantic slave trade as a crime against humanity. So after three communist bills were turned down and shut down by the socialist-led Jospin government, a young, newly elected socialist MP, Christian Taubira, was chosen to lead the government mission to apaiser les demandes ultramarines. And Taubira presented a new bill to the National Assembly in February 1999, which, after a few readings in both houses, got passed unanimously on the 10th of May 2001. I'm saying all these dates because they will actually become slightly important afterwards. So the law that would actually come to be known as the Loi Taubira recognised the status of the transatlantic slave trade as a crime against humanity, cited the school curricula and research programmes accorderont à la traite négrière et à l'esclavage la place conséquente qu'ils méritent. And it called for an adequate international cooperation on the issue of commemoration of slavery. And lastly, which is where we get into this committee, prescribed the creation of an expert committee to institutionalise the commemoration of the slave trade and its abolitions. So there were two abolitions in France. This committee was first launched in 2004 by the Chirac government under the directorship of Maryse Condé, the author, and had 12 members, mostly high-profile academics like François Vergès and Eddie Schmitt, but also Caribbean activists. These included Henriette Dorion-Sebluès, which is the president of the Union des Guyanais des Amis de la Guyane, but also the aforementioned Serge Romagnat, who by this time had actually established his reputation as the kind of the grassroots authority and memory, and founded an association that was called Comité de Marche 98, in order to continue what had been started with the kind of unexpected success of the protest in 1998. So for this, for the government, actually the committee's main role was to provide a way to unite academics, and particularly historians, with grassroots activists. Historians were supposed to represent dispassion, debate, expertise, and for the government, it was clear that grassroots activists were going to show some kind of communitarism. So the Tourbillon law itself was seen very differently by governments and activists alike. So the government presented it as kind of a moral victory to show the Republic's rejection of the evil of slavery. For activists, the law was a part of some kind of a blueprint of what at that time had actually turned into memorial activism. And you can say that it's the blueprint that had been established by Jewish activists seeking the recognition of France's responsibility for the fate of French Jews during the Second World War. So their struggles for memory gained quantifiable objectives for many activists in France, and these included legal recognition, the erection of memorials, changes to France's sacrosanct curriculum, and, of course, the establishment of a Memorial Day. So, while the newly established committee was supposed to bridge the supposed gaps between activist demands and the perceived constraints of the Republican narrative, the historians and its team saw their mission as providing a voice for the concitoyens issus de l'esclavage. Here, the case of Françoise Vergès later became the committee's president, is probably the most telling. So Vergès came from a family that has actually held power in the Réunion for generations, and found a way towards the history of slavery as a more personal mission. Her first academic post was in Goldsmiths in London, and there she became increasingly involved with the Échec, which I assume most people here have heard of, and their first work about the legacies of colonialism in France. So she perceived the role as an academic more through a desire to reach a broader public and influence its narrative rather than actually publish in academic journals. Nonetheless, while Vergès perceived herself as an activist historian, her goals in an academic community often actually clashed with community activists. And this is where the big conflict actually comes into the picture, which is kind of the main thing about this paper. And it was actually born out of the committee's main objective, and that was to find a memorial day to commemorate slavery and its abolitions in France. So the government brief specified that the date that needed to be found for it needed to relate at least loosely to aspects of both the history of the slave trade, its abolitions, and also prompt national consensus, while avoiding being too closely related to any single community or region. So this became relatively difficult. The committee found the first two obvious dates, abolitions, symbolically problematic, because of any abolition date would have actually perpetuated an abolitionist narrative and overshadowed the motivation of commemorating the crime of transatlantic slave trade instead of celebrating the greatness of abolition. Now, the other more obvious date, the 23rd of August, the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, was discarded just because it was in the middle of school holidays and that cannot actually be Memorial Day. So while discussing many other dates, Christian de Villaux, who came to be interviewed, suggested why not actually just commemorate my own law. So therefore, the date that was chosen, the 10th of May, which celebrated the moment in which les élus de la République ont adopté à l'unanimité une loi historique universelle à la fois. So basically, it was both the Republic recognizing the crime as well as celebrating its own sort of record of being right, and also celebrating the struggle of descendants of slaves to actually make their voices heard. So this wasn't the end of it though, because at the same time, Self Women Now with a member of the committee actually wanted to celebrate 23rd of May, which wasn't the day the Tobiai Law was passed, but the day the first actual protest against the 1998 sort of government plan happened. And the moment this didn't pass, he just severed all ties with the committee and left. Now, the conflict then prompted the emergence of actually two competing commemorations of slavery and its abolition. So you had on every year you had the 10th of May, which turned into an official commemoration day, and the 23rd of May, which was fashioned as a Parisian Caribbean event that kept on creating some kind of resistance to the government. And between 2005 and 2011, there were actually no ties between the Women Now and the government commemoration. But at some point after Françoise Vergès became the committee's president in 2008, she saw it as one of the biggest barriers of the committee's work because it was unable to unify different voices in France, called Self Women Now, in her own words, begged for peace. This was facilitated by her lobbying to get the government to recognise Women Now's association as the legitimate voice of the Caribbean community in France. But this peace lasted for a very short time because in 2012 Vergès was replaced by another historian, Myriam Coutillas, as the president of the committee, and Coutillas was was a lot less of an activist historian. She considered that her job was to phase la mémoire s'est achevée et les gens maintenant veulent l'histoire. Faut bien que ça se normalise. Well, it doesn't mean that Coutillas was in any way unsympathetic to the plight of Caribbean communities in France. Her greatest desire was actually to raise awareness of the role of the Haitian Revolution in ending slavery, to show African agency, to demonstrate how the system of slavery introduced racial categories into the French legal system, and introduced men and women to in France, the multifaceted reality of enslavement in the French colonies. So, what she actually wanted to do is to talk about introduire la complexité into the debate, in a way which has become also staple language for Anglophone scholars writing about slavery. But for activists, and especially for the Women Now, this showed that, and this is again, quote, this is Coutillas, une historienne, elle comprend rien. Peut-être l'histoire si.
So this kind of short and convoluted history is really about trying to get a bit of everything about who did what. In this process of getting this into this debate about slavery beyond academia. So if it hadn't been for community activists who had harnessed the memory of slavery to speak of their own links to the contemporary republic, the works of historians would not have actually become so politically charged in the first place. Could have said more about that than at time. The French context provided a very specific incubation ground for this debate.
On the one hand, it provided memorial activists with a kind of plan of action in the form of a memorial blueprint. On the other, politicians have integrated the vocabulary of memory into their discourse. So when the Tobiai Law was actually enacted, it was based on accepted vocabulary. And lastly, historians have been on both sides of the fence, are simultaneously contributing to the debate as political actors, and also anxious that the growing politicization of memory was leaving no space for the reconstruction of the past, which, with all its complexity, which is sometimes what they set up doing in the first place. So, really, this story raises questions about, and which are not really entirely new, about spaces where academics and non-academics interact, as well as pointing some of the particularities of the French context, which we could talk about later.
Thank you very much, Isai, and I'm sure we'll come back to a lot of those issues in the session. I have to say my takeaway point at the moment is don't start a revolution in the summer holidays.
Yes.
Important point to take away, so thank you for that. Okay, so we go back to Portsmouth now, and I'm delighted to introduce Olivia Ruiz-Zibora, who is a colleague in the School of Languages and Area Studies. She asked me to present her as my coolest colleague, but then Tony, Margaret, Emmanuel, and but more significantly, Olivia has recently co-edited with Robbie Schiller at Queen Mary University of London, the Handbook of Postcolonial Politics, which, as she pointed out to me, has 30 chapters in it, which in turn suggests that postcolonial politics is not dead.
Okay, so I'm very happy to be here, and it was kind of a surprise because I was not supposed to be here. So I kind of, I'm a real imposter in the sense that I just last week said, let me participate in this conference. The reason why I was so eager to do so, especially on this panel, which tried to touch on the everyday to some extent, or the beyond academic discussions we can have, it's because I had a paper ready, and also I've given a presentation on this twice last year, one of which Frances Davis was actually there. It was an attempt in Paris to bridge the Francophone Anglophone discussions about race racism in our respective countries. What I think I would try to, maybe first asterisk is that I am I'm not an historian. So I'll probably have the supervisor of always focusing on power and inequality and all these things. And what I would like to do is to think through the implications of what the postcolonial, and in my case I focus even more on the decolonial, might actually mean for our knowledge production systems in general. So in that sense, I think we can have very easily an interdisciplinary discussion. Rather than getting stuck at the level of deconstruction, and I think that would be one of the main critiques I would have, you know.
So our own postcolonial attempt is often just to highlight all the things that are wrong, and then somehow we end up forgetting, okay, so now that we get where everything gets wrong, maybe we're at the end of our career, so there's no time or, you know, or life to just happen. And I was reminded of this when Jodi was mentioning that a lot of the activism we see today, that there is nothing new about it. And what I was hearing is I was thinking, to what extent is that important? And I think it is important to the extent that maybe we should focus more on, if it is a new, if a lot of what we're saying is not new, how come we're still active? I'm not going to give the answers, but let's say that at least what I'm going to try to say in the next 10 minutes is about trying to push more for a focus on the implications. And the way we'll do this is through a very banal, not banal, but let's call it banal, example of the recurrent Black Beat discussions that we have in the Netherlands and in the Flemish part of Belgium. So I am from Antwerp, from the Flemish part of Belgium myself. I was born there, I grew up there, I even dressed up like Black Beat at some point in my in my childhood, and suddenly it's become a bit of a discussion. So very briefly to, I don't know if everybody is familiar with it, but let's say that it's something like Santa Claus, instead of reindeers, he would have helpers that are clearly from African origin, but the African origin of the whole thing has kind of been expunged, so now it's just every random person can blackface themselves.
Multicolored faces.
Yeah. So
blue face.
But in Flanders and the Netherlands, it's always been like really literally black shoes mixed. So it's really about blacking your face. The funny thing is, and I think also the fact that I moved from Flanders to here, is that if I explain this example in many of the academic circles or the progressive circles, whatever, in the UK. Just me saying people are blackfacing themselves is enough to somehow sense that there might be a problem there, whereas in Belgium we're very much still at the level of why are you making a problem out of it? Okay? But, you know, just to be honest, the reason why I started by saying that I grew up with this is that it's a process of politicization, which is that most of my life I did not see the problem in that, even though.
So what happened is that, let's say, maybe, I don't know, 7-5 years ago, especially in the Netherlands, there's a lot of activism that happened around it, so it's parallel to the stories that, you were telling, mostly from people with migrant backgrounds in the Netherlands that tried to have a voice in this and say, it's not acceptable that every single year we have this tradition, so we have to revisit the tradition. And the arguments were mostly read, again, at, you know, this black and brown people trying to change our norms and values and our traditions. It's a very innocent holiday. Why are you trying to touch on this? Whereas on the other hand, on the side of the activists, they were basically saying, our societies are so segregated that for most kids growing up in our regions, the first exposure they have to a person with a dark skin color is through that tradition. And the problem there was that it was not just just an innocent trope, let's say, but it was a trope of either the helpless slash the slave, but also if as a kid you were had been bad throughout the year, it was black people that was going to put you in the bag and take you away with them. So it was both the trope of the funny minstrel kind of type, or on the other hand, the black man should be. So the background of the paper, and so that whole discussion then suddenly is always kind of like 3-5 years later that whatever happens in the Netherlands. So we also started having this discussion, and last year what we saw is that the public broadcasters, some schools, whatever, they signed a pact where they were suggesting that why don't we try to have the same tradition but in a way that's not offensive to people. So the discussion never goes very much further than trying not to offend people. So people in the UK know what I talk about. somehow neutralizing every discussion to let's just be nice to each other, not offend them. So now the whole idea is, let's give them different colors, or just a few shoes mirror, whatever thing, rather than the whole black race thing. But obviously, these propositions that have been, you know, received quite positively on Twitter. You could, you know, Twitter is very useful to to highlight some aspects of the discussion. I will show you some of these slides, but I guess the story that I want to bring here and why I call it banal is that it's somehow, to some extent, it's a bit humiliating to have to make the case for decolonization or anti-racism, whatever, even through something as stupid, let's say, as a fictional character in a kid's holiday, to one extent. But on the other hand, I find it a very useful tool to think through some of the impediments of how we can have all these different activism all throughout these many decades and always to come back to the same thing somehow. So when we try to think about reactions of innocence, of intention, of not knowing, of amnesia, forgetting, of so, and I find that this very banal example kind of helps us do it. And in the paper that I wrote, it's being tied back to the challenge that we have within the academy and within our thinking in, and I gave the example of IR because the paper is in postcolonial studies, and it's a forum on the book by John Hobson, Eurocentric Conception of World Politics, and it goes all the way back to 1760 to thinkers today. All the big ones are in there, the ones that we not try to get out of the curriculum, but we calibrate them. And he's trying to organize all these different thinkers to the extent that they are Eurocentric or paternalistic or imperialist or racist. Long story short, he arrived at 45, and all the thinkers after that, they can't be qualified as racist because racism, especially scientific racism, has been discredited through the Holocaust and Nazism. And so there's a lot of pushback that came to that classification because he was saying that obviously they're deeply problematic and they're Eurocentric, whatever, but he didn't want to use the label racist. So the contribution I made was we need to think through our reluctance to use that word. What does it allow us to do? And for me, it's not about labeling everything as racist, but it says something about an avoidance of politics when the one word that we all agree that we're against is the one word that we try to avoid at all costs when we try to address issues of
social injustice. That's what I did. How many more minutes I have? Okay. So yeah, I'll try to come back to some things in the Q&A then. So this slide, I wanted just to highlight the connection between, or maybe also the value there is in trying to not make this huge disconnection between the discussions we have in everyday life and the public debate, and the things that we think we've already solved academically, or in terms of how do we construct, for instance, international relations. And yeah, this was the first week in that context. It's a bit too obvious, these two connections. to speak to the strategic reluctance then in the use of the racism as an analytical category. So I don't want to use it as a blanket conversation closer or blame game or whatever, but how can we not use it as an analytical category to understand how inequality is being enacted and reproduced? And again, one of the things that come out is really the reticence comes from people being so uncomfortable with that word, and that could be in the everyday, but thinking that if we avoid it, then somehow also the problem disappears. And then what I try to get at is that, and I think it was also flagged up in some of the things that we talked about today, some of the recurring things that come up in the critiques against a lot of the activism, it wasn't intended like that, and I think the Black Peace discussion shows that this is a kid's holiday. How can it be to blame for anything? It cannot be racist because it's a children's and holiday. So this idea of innocence is not limited to kids, obviously. So in a lot of the debates that we have, I find it also very useful lens. It's this idea that I did not mean it to be racist. It was not in the intention, hence it is. But that's again where we reduce racism, obviously, to an individual activity rather than a structural problem. and so in the decolonial approach, I tried to both deconstruct and reconstruct in terms of strategies, three avenues that we might have to keep in mind. And one is obviously, what is the content of the knowledge that we produce in general about the world? And a very urgent need to demythologize a lot of the things. And as historians, again, not to demythologize, to create a brand new absolute truth, but at least already to highlight the fact that there are many different truths, but which ones are the ones that are usually left out. And so the example here, and I think in demythology, what really comes out is this idea that there is a sanctioned amnesia, a structural amnesia, but also a sanctioned ignorance. And it's not an amnesia and ignorance that everybody's afforded, or everybody's allowed to have. So when we have our discussions about the syllabus, the suggestion that, let's say, BME students are not smart enough to read that, whatever, the obvious thing is obviously that you can't get a degree unless you've read this guy, but the other way around. So the ignorance or the amnesia are the things that are left out are very specific detail, and I think there is a scope to be more open-minded about it or explicit. So for instance, the question in this Flemish Lion tweet, it's a parallel that is drawn, that can only be drawn if there is complete absence of any historical context in which the fictional being of subject is, you can equate it with the whole, let's say, the colonial history and relations with the African continent. So that was in terms of the content of the knowledge production, let's say, but then obviously that type of content, we are able to reproduce that over the decades and decades and decades because there is a particular dealing with who are the experts and what is considered as expertise. And again, I think it's very important to highlight that it's not just about diversifying or fussing up or adding to the mix, but really to focus on what is systematically left out, which causes, but also why. And usually that's where we stop. So when we do the window dressing or the Benetton version or whatever, and our syllabus can be that as well. But if you don't work first and foremost through the implications of adding the other voices, then we could stay with the camp and stuff and only with them. And yeah, obviously one of the ways to silence is by delegitimizing, and that is a recurrent example whenever there is a critique from Vietnamese or minorities in any given country. The quickest solution is to go back where you came from, right? But I think
rather than laugh at it or dismiss it in a way that it happens in everyday life, it might be useful to see how similar debates are actually happening in terms of gatekeeping in academia. Can I have one more minute? So the third one is actually to think through decolonization as more than just at the level of representation or the representational or the knowledge that we produce and who gets to speak, who gets the microphone or not, but really to think through the anti-colonial state in terms of material sense. Because the whole Black Sea thing, the reason why I'm reluctant to say that it's banal is that I actually don't care whether it offends me or it hurts my feelings or whatever, but as long as, for instance, in Flanders or in Belgium, the unemployment, incarceration, housing, whatever, all the problems that you see in all these things are like literally colored. They're dark, they're brown, and the same goes for the UK. So one of the traps often that we also see is that people are sucked into, and especially for middle class, you know, people like me, into fighting for this representational blah, and I need to have my voice, I need to be able to speak about this. But somehow it takes us away from the stakes, and the stakes are the fact that most kids are exposed to people back in heritage through these ridiculous tropes and no others, or to all the criminal tropes that they get on TV. The direct link to the material conditions of people from that origin within our societies. So I think that's also where I would say that the future of, or the present of post-colonial thought, largely understood, amongst which also decolonial thinking, would be really to recommit actually, to make this connection between the representation of the immaterial and the very same material thinking. And I think in terms of our disciplines, it really is to bring it back to the structural argument. And for instance, teaching here in international development studies, also because Sussex was mentioned, it's really a conversation that we're trying to think through, like to what extent can you just add critical voices to international development studies without questioning the whole scope of international development studies as a department or as an institution that draws in students to then tell them, oh, it's all bad, you shouldn't do it. So somehow to be reminded of the absolute, radical or extreme consequence that comes from a commitment to post-decolonial thinking. So I guess that's what I wanted to share, and I thought that was a really good cartoon to highlight the whole connection between the economic, even the global trade, historical sense of all this discussion. I don't know, obviously McDonald's is not to blame for any of this, but you know, in terms of international economic relations, and how it's a bigger question than just identity politics of getting a seat at the table. But if you think it through, you actually get to how is it that we're organizing our society in general. Okay, then go there.
I think lots of things that we're going to come back to in the discussion. One of the things that really struck me in the different tweets that you were showing is the way in which it reveals sort of the way in which the book has adopted this language of victimhood. Yeah? And it's sort of literature on that. I think it's about the work of the year, that's one, for example. But it's sort of about other people's sensitivities, being oppressed by political correctness, gone mad, people not having a sense of humour, all that kind of thing, and the way in which that sort of feeds into the narrative of sort of the white man in danger.
Idea to Donald Trump, but also many other people. Okay, so our last but not least speaker today is Mohammed Saad from the University of the West of England, a long-time friend and collaborator of Margaret, and I know she's delighted to have you here alongside other former colleagues and dear friends. Mohammed is a specialist in innovation management and knowledge transfer, particularly in the context of the university. If that scared you, he's actually really nice.
What am I doing here?
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. And I essentially focused on
on innovation management and the role of university. Why the role of university? Because it's now increasingly appearing that well, the survival of nation or organization depends on their ability to innovate. And their ability to innovate is really dependent on the level of knowledge that they acquire or develop. And who is the main kind of producer of knowledge? The main producer of knowledge is essentially the higher education institutions. Although sometimes I talk about really education as a whole, because it starts with the primary education. If countries like Algeria are having problem at the higher education level, it's because there was a vacuum in the primary and secondary that was actually taken by others who had a hidden agenda and transformed actually the whole country into where it is. But I think what is happening in Algeria is probably happening in quite a lot of countries. Now in Algeria there is relatively young, dynamic Minister of Education who is trying to address those issues, but she is constantly attacked by people and institution and organization who do not feel comfortable and feel threatened by the ideas that she's bringing into primary education. And this really kind of, you know, takes me to also say that although I'm, you know, looking at this role of university in the production of innovation, and therefore, but I would probably also say why I'm sort of going along this line, because for a very long time I was reluctant, because for a very long time innovation was essentially measured in economic terms. But I think we are beyond those days now. Innovation is also measured in social terms, and hence the idea of social innovation becoming quite important both in developed and in developing countries. So what we are saying here, you know, can really go within the context of social innovation rather than innovation as it has always been seen before as being either economic or technical. So university has always been seen as important in the creation of knowledge, but you know, there were some models and theories which were developed in the 60s which recognized the role of university but didn't see the university as the most important stakeholder within or actor within this production of innovation. They saw the industry as being the key actors, hence the importance of the technical aspect and the economic aspect. But recently, with probably a series of motives, one of which is probably the funding, universities are now trying, or governments are pushing universities to make money, to exploit their knowledge. So universities now are kind of moving slowly to becoming, you know, I don't like the term, but it is being used by the literature as, you know, becoming more entrepreneurial. Of course, as soon as we talk about the university becoming more entrepreneurial, you know, we are worried, because are we going to sell our souls and just look after commercializing our knowledge? That's one school of thought. On the other hand, you could also say it's true that we as university, we produce a lot of knowledge, but we don't bother about whether this knowledge is going to be used by others. We just leave it in our books, in our drawers, on our desk, on our or in our computers, but we don't bother about, you know, trying to see whether this knowledge can be used by the society in order to improve life, in order to solve problems, because this is the definition of innovation. Innovation is any new idea which is implemented and helps solving a problem, any problem. Not only producing new products or new software or whatever, it's any new idea, new to the context where it is applied, even if it has been applied somewhere else, but helps addressing, you know, problem or finding a solution. So there are these two schools of thought which are trying to sort of say, no, we want to remain as we are, but remaining, you know, as we are means being in the Ivory Coast. Ivory Tower, sorry. Ivory Tower. With all respect to Ivory Coast. and not kind of knowing what is happening around us. It is true that for a very long time, when universities were given some autonomy, universities were developing some kind or some programs of teaching or research based on their own interests, not on the interests of the society as a whole. So there is this push to entrepreneurial university, which is happening both in developed and in developing countries. I know of a few examples, for instance. I know of a university in Ethiopia, and I always present it like that. I say they were lucky to be funded by NGOs and not by government. Why I'm saying they were lucky? Because in fact, this university, most of the lecturers, if not all the lecturers, were graduated or had their doctorate or their thing abroad. When they went to their country, they were actually developing teaching and research programs that they have acquired in foreign university, regardless of the interest of their environment in which they were operating. And the NGOs actually reviewed the system and say, unless you transform, you know, you develop the teaching and the research activities which respond to the rural needs of your environment, unless you do that, or we stop the training. Of course, there is an issue about this type of knowledge. The most important scholar, who is British, who has worked on it, actually describe it as being multidisciplinary and applied. Okay. Multidisciplinary and applied, and define it as a useful knowledge. And I think we are all, to some extent, happy with the useful knowledge which can satisfy or help the environment. As I have 2 minutes, the other issue that I also looked at is most of the work which work looking at the links between innovation and universities is based on research activities, not on teaching. Teaching is not being recognized as leading to innovation. And we did, managed to get some funding. For 2 years, we did some research. I wanted that research to be very much based on developing countries, but unfortunately, there were too much missed data as far as the developing countries. So we managed to get only data about the OECD countries. And we found that actually that the places where teaching was of high quality, the countries were very innovative. There was a strong link between innovation and teaching, We also wanted to see whether public, you know, public organizations were also very much based with linked to innovation. And you know, the innovation is essentially measured in terms of patents, publication, and R&D. There was always a debate that it's not always the right thing, but most of the researchers actually measure it in terms of patent, public funding, and patent, publication, and budget allocated to R&D. And we found that actually that the public funding lead more to publication than to patents, and the private funding lead to patent. I think, as I probably have to conclude, I would say academics, sometimes we also try to simplify things, and we think that we only have to adopt one model or the other. And in education, what is being successful is actually when there is some kind of diversity. So we also looked at the case of Algeria as another developing country. We found some collaboration. Surprisingly, we didn't think we were going to find some collaboration. We found some collaboration, but that collaboration was around teaching. And I just wish that most of the Algerian university, or most of the developing the university in developing countries, actually concentrate more on teaching leading to innovation, rather than actually moving to some kind of research which, in the case of Algeria, is hardly delivering output. There are problems about the Algerian university that I wanted to mention, which probably is linked to the history of the country. I don't know, but there is a problem of university being too much dependent on the central power of the government, no autonomy at all in terms of this, you know, making major and strategic decisions. The language in which the teaching is being done or the research is also badly managed. Algeria, rightly so, I think that's legitimate, to opt for the, you know, start teaching in Arabic, but that teaching in Arabic actually was done in a way which created a lot of conflicts and a lot of problems. And what is happening now, we see more and more, well, not more, but we see most of the postgraduate teaching being done in French, whereas the teaching in primary and secondary is done in French. The third problem is actually the mass education that the country has opted for, which is a good thing, provided you've got the resources for it. And most of the resources are actually spent on issues which are not so much related to the quality of teaching and the quality of research. And reforms are coming, but I think my reading of the reforms is most of universities are in a mess. We are going to leave them in a mess, but we are going to create schools, just like in France, les grandes écoles, for the elitist.
Thank you very much for having lots of questions from all our panelists about the relationship between knowledge, academics, university, wider society, the superstructure. I actually really want to know where this place was in Oran. That's a real question, I think. But to start off, while everyone's sort of maybe thinking of what question they want to ask, do any of the panelists have questions for each other? Yes, sorry, I should have warned you. But, you know, things that you heard when each other was speaking that sort of particularly echoed what you had to say, or... I mean, maybe sort of talking about sort of the repetitiveness of these debates. They seem to be like the same old debate. Why are we still having the same debate?
That's a difficult question, but it is an important one. I mean, there are definitely. I wonder if they're not exactly the same. Mm-hmm. They have moved on in some ways. I think some of the stuff I was talking about are sort of precursors to, or you know. So we are in some ways we are in a cyclical manner talking about the same kinds of things, but in slightly different ways. And there is some sense that things are changing.
I think the more we repeat the debate, whether whatever topic we are discussing, the more we kind of go in depth and highlight the complexity of things. And there is nothing wrong with repeating the debate as long as we come up with something new in terms of understanding the issue. In the context of innovation, I mean, we have progressed tremendously in the understanding of innovation from the Schumpeter time, for whom innovation was essentially dependent on the company having resources and investing that on research, to today, where we try to find out all the variables, the many variables, cultural, social, historical, geographical, etc., which have an influence on the production of innovation. And I think this, I'm sure, is quite similar to all debates that are repeated.
I don't think these debates are actually the same at all. I mean, not only that they are slightly different, but you could of course reduce them to the lowest common denominator, and tweets are very good often with that, because they usually repeat themselves in one of the same way in every country. But they're done on an extremely different scale between very different people and also very different actors. So I mean, especially if you look at this. If you look at the differences between debates in Britain and France, I think the reason I chose the story is that it is unthinkable in Britain. Mm. Every part of it, not the arguments that are used, but the idea of a government appointing a committee to legislate about memory, even some of the roles that some historians have actually played is not necessarily something that I've seen in Britain. I mean, there is some of what has been happening in France in terms of debates, memory, all these things, regardless of positive, negative, whatever that is done on a very different scale to Britain. This is again done on a very different scale to other European countries, or is done in a very, or just from very different actors. So I think there is. So I think these differences are actually the story. Trying to see why, even though, let's say, and kind of selling my own research here, even though Britain and France do have are based in colonial history in a way, why are the debates so different? Mm. Why have they reached such different scales? Mm.
Yeah, I think we have to research that, but I think it might also be useful, and I don't know which one we should prioritize, and it's not a competition, whatever, but in terms of, and maybe that's sometimes a problem I have with not the word innovation in itself, but the way innovation is obviously being pushed down, so is that there is an element of progressive change, right? And it's somehow still the ideal for most of us. We feel progressive if slowly by slowly we see things changing. And so I think when I point to the fact that we keep on coming back, it's not like 20 years ago maybe I started this discussion,
I wouldn't even have had the position to make this claim. So the same thing is the fact that a million people have been saying this stuff long before me. So there's nothing new there to some extent, an example mm-hmm. that you gave. But there is a progression in the fact that we do our window dressing, we do the picking the boxes, mm-hmm. whatever. We have more women, we have more people of color, whatever, in these places. And I think the challenge is then to make sure we don't say the same thing. And so when I look, for instance, at the allergic reaction to discussions on colonialism and racism in Flanders, in the UK, or in France, it is really interesting in terms of what are the strategies that we're going to use to look at the differences. But I think, politically at least, it's much more important to focus on the shared allergic reaction. And that is something that does not change unless we somehow commit to something more radical than just informing more people about slavery or informing more people about... And so an extreme example that sometimes... It's not even that extreme, but let's say the current crisis refugee crisis that we have in the Mediterranean today. So one thing about the progressive change would be we need to listen more to the stories of these people that actually make the cross. And usually it's used to almost neutralize the politics. It's just about having empathy with the difficulties that they physically have to get here. And if they get here, we give the microphone and we can listen to them. Whereas if it's really about radically taking the implications of the fact that the people to whom it actually happens are not in our ivory tower, are not in our syllabus, and are not... If you flip it around, then you understand that dying in the Mediterranean has nothing to do with just poverty or whatever, but just the existence of borders. But that is so fundamental that that's also why we keep on just every other decade. We give the microphone to refugees to plus up our stories. But there is no commitment to think through the reason why they were never there in the first place for us to teach about in a way that is impactful. I don't know if... So that's why I would focus more on how come there is a similar performance, even though I do think that looking at it, I learned a lot by just moving to the UK. I also feel freer to say to people in Flanders, I'm not going to repeat it. I'm not going to prove to you that it's racism. It's the assumption from which I'm going to say anything after. Mm-hmm. That's something that I learned from the UK where people do political correctness, even though the racism is also here. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, I don't know. It's not really to say anything against what was just said, but I do think we're missing something that makes that there is a circular...
Do you think that's part of the counter-argument to keep us in that loop? We don't move on. We don't say, okay, I'm not going to explain to you again why this is racist. We're just going to assume that that's true. But there's a way in which keeping us in that loop, though, is...
Yeah, it's about...
Problematic.
So let's say, for instance, this article that just came out.
Yeah.
I mean, the timing...
Which I happen to have with me.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. So Third World Tragedy is supposed to be... You know, this place, a journal where...
I think we should read the abstract for those who haven't heard of it. It's a short one and it's enlightening.
Yeah, you should read the abstract. I've
read the abstract.
It's very...
You've read it? Yeah. Well, he makes a case for recolonizing.
Colonialism has that price.
To reinvigorate best practice.
Colonialism can be recovered by weak and fragile states today, by reclaiming colonial modes of governance, by recolonizing some areas, and by creating new Western colonies from scratch.
Yeah. So this guy, for instance, came to Duisburg. I was in Duisburg the year before, and he was invited at a conference, and I remember listening again. But what shocked me was not so much what he was saying, because he was echoing, recuperating stuff that any populist argument, you know, all the tweets that I showed, there's nothing new in what he says. Like, we built the roads, we brought them education, and we keep on doing it in development studies anyway. So there's nothing new or shocking about the content. What for me was shocking was that my institution had invited him, and today more shocking is that Third World Quarterly
published
him. So the discussion is not always about, you know, what are these people saying? There's nothing. So I think here, to answer your question, the challenge is to not be dragged into a conversation about the content of what he's saying, But to say I have, I don't know, I have 10 hours in a day, how many of the hours am I going to use to talk back to this?
Yeah.
And how much of my energy do I actually use for the next step? And I feel that so far, too much, we've been happy that finally we're part of this discussion. It's exciting and we compare whatever, but we, there is a standstill as well. I don't know.
But don't you think that this is something, and this is something I don't find circular at all. I think this is something that is definitely more of the last 20 years of a lot of, and this is something I find a lot more Anglo-centered than anything else, this extreme kind of individualization of activism,
yeah.
of turning a lot of these kind of debates about history, about discourses, back to things that relate to individual emotions. Whereas, for example, in France, and this is something like, regardless of the toxic element of the debate in France, and regardless of some of the moments you just look at it and think how on earth is this possible? But there is still. But what I find very different here between Britain, France, and then also if you look at other European countries that import debates from the Anglo sphere on different levels, is how the debate in France is actually not very centred on individual emotion. It is a lot more centred on the state, on this kind of on collective responsibility. Whether that gets anything better, it's a completely different question. But I always find that to be a big difference than actually. Noting the difference, don't really know where it gets us. But in terms of the circularity of the debate,
yeah.
Or why are we actually entering these wonderful blogs, wonderfully written blogs that denounce forms of very individualised racism in Taylor Swift videos, which have traction. I mean, and yet where does it get us?
Can we open up the questions to the audience? Or comments? Margaret's going to tell us about
my thing is not that. As someone who is old enough to have been around in the 60s and 70s and involved in activism, I just want to put a couple of points to you and see how you respond, really. One is that I think the kind of demands and forms of struggle and achievements even that were made in the late 60s, early 70s primarily, I see, you know, evidence these days, not just of as you were talking about, a repetition of the debates, but actually a huge regression. So a lot of the things that were actually achieved, especially in the last year or two in Britain, have gone to a very large extent. That's my first point. My second one is really to make the comparison, I think, in terms not just of what was the analysis in terms of racism or in terms of, and I would extend it also to gender, not just oppression, exploitation, and so on, but also the ambition of the people who were engaged in active resistance and forms of struggle then. I would say that the ambition that they had, or we had, was far greater than anything that I see today in terms of rather, I'm not dismissing demands that are made today, but they seem to be much less ambitious in their scope and the kinds of things that were demanded in that period of time. And the last thing I would sort of put to you, for comment, is any of this due to theory? Because the kind of theorization that was dominant in the 60s and 70s in terms of anti-racism and so on was very much based on a more general theory of imperialism across the world, and it seems to me it was much more founded in a general understanding of world politics across the board than what we have today. And how far, to bring us back to the theme of this workshop, is how far is post-colonial theory from Foucault? Sorry, that's wrong. Anyone else in the audience want to respond to that while our panelists are thinking?
Well, maybe I could say a few things. I think you're right that there was, I think, a utopian urge. You know, there was the people I was interviewing for the Hippie Trail book. I mean, the assumption was that they would just grow up into a much, much transformed world. They took it for granted. Mm. But I don't need to tell you, Margaret, I mean, with that, there were an awful lot of assumptions sometimes. They just hadn't thought through a number of things.
I'm not idealising.
Well, you were a little bit.
But I think, I mean, I agree with you, and sometimes also say that in the past, we had to take into consideration in the way we were looking at things and analysing things, you know, which group do you belong to, East or West? And that was really have a dominance on our thinking about anything. You know. And the other point I was saying that I was going to say is I feel that now people, or maybe young people, have actually are more demanding than young people in the old time. Don't know if it's clear what I'm saying, but I think it's
more demanding in which way?
In any way.
And young people like
when you look at I don't know. Well, you look at maybe it's their rights, but when you look at immigration, if I take the North African immigration in France or the Asian immigration in here, they were actually low profile. They were there just to earn some money and accepting anything that it was imposed on them. That's not the case of the second and the third generation. And maybe we can generalize, I don't know.
Well, because they're not migrants,
right? Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. No, I think those are really good questions. That I tried to think about as well. I think it actually ties to what you're saying about the individualized versus the structural one. And there I would say, if I do compare continental Europe with, say, Belgium and France, and then here, it's true that, very simplistically, but the neoliberal version of whatever struggle that you can have is much more explicit in the UK. I can experience it then. But I would say that it's probably an opportunity and an impediment in both sides. My problem with, let's say, negotiation, it's not even a negotiation, but the negotiation of the hijab or something, is not the fact that it's done through La République or the structures. It's the fact that the imaginary of that République or structure is extremely white. Again, to put it very simplistic, white and male. So then, sometimes, like, as a middle-class individual of as a visible minority moving from Belgium to here, my life here is much more easy than it is in Belgium because I am being addressed. And it's a phony one because if I weren't from this class or if I didn't have access to academia, then I would not benefit from this neoliberal reality. But on the other hand, if the French idea of itself was not that white, yeah, then that state would be... So the line might maybe not be just individual versus structure, but again, what is something collective, imagining how inclusive is it, and then also what are the consequences. So I do agree with you that there is a lot of regression, especially in the mainstream discussions. Again, there the comparison is very funny. Sometimes when we bring up the example of the UK or the US, it's always to say, yeah, no, but their history is completely different. And then they bring up, we have to stop being so politically correct. Mm. And then I say, but that's the biggest difference. In the UK, you have the 70s where people thought of this whole idea through struggle, political correctness, however you define it. But in Belgium, we skipped it. But today we say, we have to stop being politically correct. And there are real consequences there. That's why we can have this ridiculous discussion that in the UK you wouldn't have. And at first instance, you would have the impression that everything is better here, but it isn't. It's just a different form. So, yeah, in terms of less ambition, I think that we were raised, our generations, with the end of history blur, meaning that somehow it's like in the 60s and the 70s, the fight was fought. And so in school growing up, you get the idea that we found the solution, now it's just about protecting it through innovation on the thing and exporting it somewhere else. So I think a lot of the generations now, you almost don't even dare to make a claim to a utopia because you get all the information of how wrong it was and how badly it turned out. But I do see a positive element in a sense, because where you were talking about theorizing a theories and a more global outlook on the struggle, I think what some people are doing today is actually have this connected history and the global outlook, but they do not need this overarching search for the truth to do that, because there is a recognition of the violence that was imbued in that. So, yeah, it's not a straight answer, but I think a lot is going on, but I think it's politically useful to look not at it as in terms of progressiveness, in the sense that there are more color and more women and more whatever people around. And I don't want to dismiss it, because it is a real accomplishment of real struggle that, you know, even saying that formal colonization ended, my assumption today is to say, yeah, but colonization continues, but we can't fall in the trap of dismissing that struggle, because it was monumental. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to balance regression versus progression. I don't know, but yeah.
I think, actually, it's a very personal opinion, that if, I mean, beyond that kind of individual structural whatever, I think I think actually today's young activists seem to be a lot more ambitious than the ones in the 60s and 70s. I just sometimes think that these ambitions are more difficult to attain. And this is also this was probably also my difficulty with saying, well, these debates are cyclical and they occur all the time, because the kind of activism that occurred in the 1960s and 70s was also sometimes successful due to it being very specific. It was a lot easier to fight for changing laws in the 1960s and the 70s than it is today. And that also means that a lot of the debate today starts from realizing that despite changes in law, this utopian thinking maybe has never really been achieved, but it becomes very difficult to just find the exact objectives that need to be attained for this utopia to be, or not even utopia, but values to actually emerge.
What about the fact, though, that there's generally been a loss of political culture? So anyone who teaches now will know that he has to explain virtually every concept to students, like, from the start. How do you start even explaining what post-colonialism is when they don't know what Marxism is? And I think, you know, that it goes back to sort of what Olivia was saying about the decoupling, if you like, of identity from sort of engagement sort of with real, concrete, material, social, economic questions. Those two things have to be examined together. Because actually, you know, sort of neoliberalism has been very good at sort of cherry-picking aspects of identity politics. You know, look at Ireland now, you know, they've got a gay person of colour as their prime minister. What's that done for women's rights? You know, not a lot. But actually, this sort of window dressing has for a certain sort of centre-right, centre-left elite, has been used very effectively by them without changing any of the sort of, you know, the structural, institutional racism, patriarchy, any of those things. They haven't really changed. They've been slightly improved. And I think that sort of the loss of political culture, I'm talking particularly about Britain here, sort of with the rise of Thatcherism, individualism, so concepts that would have been very easily available to everybody. You know, anyone who was in the trade union would know what, you know, Marxism was, what capitalism was in the 1970s. All of that has been lost, And so, you know, these things about identity seem accessible, but they're actually totally unanchored from any sort of broader system in which they would acquire something meaningful. And that's why we get all these stupid debates, basically, about things that don't really matter. Andrew!
I was going to say as well, like, I thought perhaps one of the ways you can frame that idea of, like, institutional versus individual problems is, again, kind of like Olivia was saying, by turning on his head as well, looking not for a kind of paucity of ambition or activism amongst younger people or whatever, but actually a feeling on, like, a theoretical level, but looking at something like Marxism as being, you know, 19th century ideology, which really perhaps, when you look at kind of social political changes, the way the debates have progressed, perhaps doesn't address itself in the same immediate way. The idea that, you know, when we talk about trade union culture, for example, the kind of the demise of trade union culture, and not my knowledge of political culture, but actually the demise of trade union membership. One way you would have known about trade unions would be if your parents were in one. Now that's much less likely. You know, the idea of that kind of disaggregation, the atomization of social kind of social political culture, I think produces a sort of disengagement. So perhaps the problem is looking for, like, different theories of stake and can motivate people. And actually, I think there is some of that. It's, you've done a lot of work on looking at, you know, anti-gender leadership, and perhaps, like, what someone like that group has is something which is much more kind of attractive, immediate for a younger person, kind of, who is engaged in a similar activism. And, you know, when we talk about ambition, you look at people, that young lassie that was the, what do you call it, you know, down the far right after she made those claims that, you know, science must fall because of its basis. Ultimately, you know, fine, whatever, it might be kind of misinformed or ill-informed or whatever, but ultimately, that's ambitious. You know, I mean, to overturn the canon of Western science, that's a hell of an ambition, regardless of what you think of the actual thing. So I think there is, like, some of that there, but perhaps it's, we're now finding ourselves in a situation where we're kind of getting to look for a sort of optimistic future and let them look for something which frames kind of contemporary debates in a new and interesting way, because those old views perhaps play that, you know. So it's about changing the record as well. That's kind of makes the old songs.
Any other thoughts? We're going to pass it back to Margaret. Just before we do, I have is it Margaret who raised the issue of gender? Because we didn't really have a chance to talk about intersectionality, but we probably should have done. But just as a sort of personal reflection, Margaret has always been a brilliant champion of women in academia. I know you started at a time when there were very, very few women in academia. I remember you sitting me down when I came back from my first maternity leave and giving me a pep talk that meant a lot to me at the time, but I can see you can't remember it, but that's okay. But
I'm glad that you
That's the most important thing, really. But thank you, Margaret, and we're going to pass over to you for the
Well, very briefly, because I've been told that we're about to be locked in or thrown out, whichever takes your choice. I just want to thank you all for coming. It's been a great pleasure and a great honour for me to come, and I'm very, very happy to see colleagues, new colleagues that I have not met before, as well as some that I've known for a very long time. Very, very pleased to see you all here today. Thanks especially to Ed for organising this event, which is, he's done all the organising, although my name is on it, I haven't done anything to organise it at all. So great thanks to Ed for doing that and for having the idea really to do it. And it's been a very good day for me, and I hope for you. And it's a pity that we have to end now in some ways, just as we're all getting into the swing of the debate. But we are going to carry on, aren't we, Ed, if you want to say a little bit about it.
We are going to carry on, yes. Sorry, I was just away negotiating because we were going to get another 5 minutes overnight for our discussion. So, yeah, we're sort of slowly making a move out of the building, but not too slowly. We thought we'd go to a pub, which is on Gun Wharf. So it's about a 10-15 minute walk from here, and the restaurant we put the tables next door for those of you who'd like to join.
What time
the
is
restaurant,
the table for?
The table is booked for 7:30 at the Estrada, and the pub next door to it is called
The old custom house.
The new one. Don't go to the new one. Yeah. So yeah, I think if anyone who wants to go as a group, you can gather out the front of the building in the next 10-15 minutes, and we'll walk out together. Otherwise, see you later.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks very much.